From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Those who know him, fellow attorneys or former clients, even his legal opponents, all say Ron Jankich is a brilliant defense lawyer. He's been confident enough to represent some of the most unpopular defendants in recent Utah history. Mark Hoffman, Francis Schroeder. Judge Paul Warner told the Deseret News a few years ago, if I was in trouble, he's the first one I would call. But where Jankich really seems to shine is in front of a jury at a closing statement. Attorney Pat Shea thinks it may have something to do with his blue-collar background. Jankich was born in a Utah mining town. His father was a labor guy. Shea says Jankich can look somebody in the eye and connect with them. Today in the program, Ron Jankich is joining us to talk about justice and mercy and God and baseball. Other stuff, too, after the news.
Still thinking about that conversation on StoryCorps? Or the story you caught last weekend on Snap Judgment? The voices you hear on public radio stay with you. You can have a lasting effect on public radio, too. KUER sustainers give ongoing monthly contributions, providing a steady stream of income so we can continue to bring you the programs you can't get out of your head. Become a sustainer today at KUER.org.
This is Radio West and Doug Fabrizio. In Utah's legal community, they say if you're accused of a crime and it doesn't look so good, you need to call Ron Jankich. First, of course, it's his legal mind, his skills as a lawyer. He's been at this for more than 40 years now. But after that, it seems to be the intangibles. Jankich is intense and ferocious at times and funny, too. They say he's really good with a jury for reasons we'll get to. Ron Jankich, of course, is a fixture in this community, an activist, outspoken progressive. He's been called a champion of the underdog. The Utah Bar recently named him Lawyer of the Year, which was all the excuse we needed, really, to talk to him. So we are. Ron Jankich is joining us here in the studio. And Ron Jankich, welcome. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you. Good to be here.
You were born in Bingham Canyon, that region of the state. And I'm wondering, it seems like that's a place... You moved when you were... How old were you when you moved?
Six, seven.
So yeah. You weren't there that long, but did it get in your blood? That
part? Oh, no. I think that anybody that is from Bingham attaches themselves to that, that is in you, because it isn't only the locale, it's the history of that mining camp. It's like people from Price, Utah, Carbon County, no matter where they are, that is an attachment. And at some point when you get to know them fairly early on, they will go back to that.
Your dad was a union man.
My dad was a union man. All of my grandfathers, my two grandfathers, my dad and all of his brothers, my mother's sisters, husbands, my cousins, my brother and I in the summer worked in the mine. And so it's kind of a big deal with us, the idea of, as you said in your opening, progressive attitude, particularly as it relates to the poor and working men.
Yeah. Did you figure, so you worked in the mine, and when you were working in the mine, did you think, this is not so bad, or I got to get the hell out of here?
Well, I mean, at that time, I worked on what were called the college gangs. And so I would come home from college, and then I would work there, and it was a really nice thing because you got paid good money at that time. And so a lot of us who did that were the second generation Americans, as I was, who were moving forward, who were the ones that literally had been lifted up by their parents based upon the movement of their parents to this country to get out of circumstances of poverty generally, and also oppression to a degree. And so it wasn't so much that it wasn't a good job. It was a good job. I had a lot of friends that stayed there.
Yeah.
And then ultimately when Ronald Reagan and the rest of those folks killed the unions, it didn't become as good a job, but they made careers out of it. But no, I think that the idea was not so much it wasn't a good job. It wasn't even an important job. It wasn't that. It was that I was to move forward. I was to go on. That was what my dad taught me.
Did you know what that meant? I mean, at what point did you start thinking of the law or academia or what? I mean, what were you thinking in those early
days?
Well,
academics were really important in our family. I mean, my dad's constant refrain was, I don't send you to school to eat your lunch. And my father was the one that would go to parent-teacher conferences. And my dad did not fear talking to the teachers and telling them. And, of course, it was a different day. And this is not to make my dad seem like a bad guy, because he wasn't. He knew what he was dealing with and trying to mold. But, I mean, he told my teachers, look, I don't want my kid interrupting the other kids either. They're here to learn. He gets out of hand. You have my right. You have the right to deal with him as you want, even if it includes corporal punishment. So, yeah. And a couple of them took him up on it.
Right. You were a good baseball player. Did you ever think that might be your path? Like, I'd like to.
No, that was my dream.
Yeah,
I mean, I wasn't that good. I mean, I was a good player. I played in high school. I played in college.
Yeah.
And I played in the Beehive State here for years. In fact, one of the best compliments I ever received in my life was, there was a man named Richard Johnson. And I think Richard's passed away now. In the Beehive State League, the Smithfield Blue Sox have always, surprisingly enough, been a great amateur feeder here in Utah. They won a national championship years ago. Richard was the manager and coach. And I was trying a rape case up in Preston, Idaho. And I saw when I drove through that the Blue Sox were playing. I thought, well, the day they're playing, we're going to do a half day. I'll go and watch the evening game. I'll go over there. And I did. And Richard happened to see me, and he introduced me to his players and, you know, jokingly said, this is the infamous lawyer, and he used to play here, play against us. And he was a pretty fair country ball player. Well, coming from him, I mean, that's like me being the most valuable player. So I loved the game, but I wasn't good enough to move on.
You went to Kentucky for school, for college. And I've heard you say that one of the reasons was you just wanted to get out of Utah for a time. Now, what did you mean by that? Like, I've got to get out of here for good. I'm through with this place, or I just need to try something else for a while. I mean, what was it?
Growing up when I did, it was different here. This was a very homogeneous society, and it was a great place to grow up, don't get me wrong, but there were currents at work that really irritated me here in Utah. And I think
about the Mormon culture?
Well, part of it, yeah. Partly, and it was the oppressive nature of the whole thing, which is to say that spreading your wings to fly in Utah at that time could be a fairly difficult thing if you weren't of the predominant culture. And I've had Mormon friends of mine say, well, that's not true. But to me, it was true.
Yeah.
And I wanted to get away. I wanted distance. And like all of the kids of my era, you're talking 1968. That was the era of rebellion, I mean, in many ways. And I wanted to get away from the home. My mom is still mad at me about that I went to Kentucky to college.
Really? What, yeah. She wanted you to stick around?
Yeah. I mean, all Italian mothers want their sons to stay near them. And I'm not joking about this. I went back to a 45th reunion or 40th reunion. I forget which of one of the baseball teams I played in. And I flew into Louisville. And I called my mom, and as, again, we all do, call my wife first, then my mother. And I got here safe. Where are you? I'm in Louisville. You know, I'm still mad that you went there. So she's held the grudge.
You know, you studied it. You got your undergraduate degree in history. And one thing I read about was that you were interested anyway for a time in Native American culture, or anyway the way Native Americans were treated. How much of that played an impact on the way you were thinking about the ideas of injustice and things like that at
oh,
all?
A lot.
Yeah.
You know, Bury My Heart at Wounded Knee and Black Elk Speaks both remain seminal books in my spiritual existence, I guess. But that whole era was an era of interest for me, particularly the progressive movement, the populist movement, and that era also encompasses the subjugation of the Plains Indians and the Indians in the West, and also the mystical nature of the Indian movement of that time with the whole thing about Wovoka and those just fascinating efforts at is Indian resurrection, you know, Chief Joseph,
yeah.
These wonderful, critically important people to American culture that I think we don't talk enough about, that we don't know about, enough about.
I'm trying to get a sense. So I'm trying to understand your sense of justice as it's developing when you're younger. And one of the things you've talked about, I mean, before you went to Bellarmine, you were at Kentucky Southern.
Mm-hmm.
This was a Baptist,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah, it's kind of weird. I mean, I had scholarships to go to what was then Southern Nevada, which is UNLV,
yeah.
Small scholarship to USU. My high school coach, Bob Sanchez, who I liked a lot, was a good guy, wanted me to go to the U. And I wanted east of the Rocky Mountains. And so I got this ridiculous scholarship at Kentucky Southern College. I had no idea what it was, but it was pretty good. And I had played baseball in Missouri one summer, and the coaches there helped out. And anyway, I got a pretty nice scholarship. And so I just went. I mean, and it was this little Baptist experimental school. And it was really a great experience. They were one of the first schools at that time to try an interdisciplinary approach to teaching. And so you didn't have just biology and chemistry and history and that. They melded them together. And because it was a religious institution, that philosophy and the history of religion and religion was very important. And just great, great professors. In fact, Harold Stassen, who ran for president
yeah.
many times, his son, who was an old man at that time, was one of the professors there. But they were great people, just great people.
Is this where you first encountered, at least in terms of seriously studying it, the Bible? Like, was this the time you really looked to the Bible for guidance about the way you perceived the world?
Yeah, that's really perceptive of you. It's true. I grew up Catholic and, you know, was and remained a believer, but, you know, we're talking 5 years post-Vatican II
yeah.
where there is a re-emphasis on biblical teaching. Those guys, the Bible was everything. And for those people at that time, it had opened up the historical exegesis of the Bible. So we started with like the Gilgamesh epic and stuff like that. That is still wonderful stuff to read. At a Baptist college. I mean, I'll never forget being blown away when we read the Gilgamesh epic and some of the other narratives of the Semitic religions. And then these guys brought it into the context, not just of the Christian and the Jewish text, but of Greek philosophy and that stuff. It was an eye-opener to me. And that really has remained with me ever since then and has been always been part of what I've studied. And there's a lot to learn there.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I think what's interesting, too, is how it is that you came to this sense of justice there. I know there was a professor. I'm not sure if it was at Bellarmine or if it was at this college, who said to you, and this is the quote you gave, he said something to this effect, justice is a living, breathing organism.
Yeah, I'm dating myself, which is cool. the people in the 60s and the early 70s will remember two men – the Berrigan brothers. They were Jesuits priests, Philip and Daniel. I always get them mixed up. One of them remained a Jesuit. One left the priesthood and married a nun. And I think that was Daniel. And he went to prison many times as a protester. And one of the professors I had actually just passed away last year. Great guy, Father Zoller. He, too, is a Jesuit school. He talked a lot about Berrigan and this and Berrigan's quest for justice and what it meant, because he was under attack from all sides in America at that time, even within Catholic academic communities and other academic communities for what he was doing. But that was, you know, basically Father Zoller's idea. You know, you've got to look at it all to determine justice, which is, again, if we go back, I mean, that bleeds through all of the philosophical traditions across the world, Native American culture. You know, you look at Chief Joseph and his attitude about what justice is, and you look at, you know, the great writers in Greek philosophy that discuss these issues.
What is the meaning of justice?
What does it mean? Yeah. What is just? But it's not only just this ephemeral meaning, and certainly the Old Testament, Deuteronomy and the parables of Jesus you know, like Jonah and Jeremiah and Isaiah and these guys, but across the board, and then the great Buddhist teachings, the Tao, all of these things are trying to find out not only what is it, but how do you apply it?
Yeah, that's the thing, right?
That's the hard thing.
And that seems like something you must wrestle with all the time, in the sense that I'm going to defend this person, and where does responsibility come into play? Where does mercy come into play? Like, how does that all plug into this bigger idea of justice?
Yeah, it does. I mean, the thing is that being a defense attorney, you're put in a position where most often you're asking for justice, which is tempered by mercy.
Right.
And the meaning of that in the context of a society which tries to distance itself from the Greek Judeo-Christian tradition, but we are immersed in it. It's who we are. Now, we've got great filters that have come in and added to that when we look at justice, but basically that's what it is. Our political system, our judicial system has historically, however, taking a real Deuteronomical view of that, the eye for the eye attitude, without looking at the rest of it. And so the concept for a defense attorney who really cares about the individual in front of them or standing beside them is to take these strict rules and say, okay, how do we put them into that? Do they fit there, or do they really stand away from it a little bit, that we don't need the full panoply of your justice? Or as a client of mine, a capital murder client one time told me, it's just ice, Ron. Don't ever forget, it's just ice. They want to put me on ice.
Wow. Did you learn something from that?
Yeah. I mean, he was a crazy guy. In fact, that was his nickname, Crazy Joe Lovato, and he was. But, yeah, I mean, that was a cool statement to me, and we're going back to about 1979. I mean, but that is a fundamental feeling that people that go into court have, innocent or guilty. All they want to do is ice me. They're not concerned about the warmth of my blood as a human being. They want to pigeonhole me as a rapist or a thief or a killer or whatever. I'm more than that. And what I think good defense attorneys do, and we have a lot of them here in Utah, is that what we attempt to do is to say the pigeonhole doesn't work for this particular person. Guilt or innocence aside, I mean, when we're talking more about people that are in fact guilty or pled guilty or been convicted,
yeah,
we need to do that. And I think for me, it's a heartbreaking thing a lot, and it's a maddening thing, and it makes me angry a lot when I hear people talk about vengeance constantly, and I hear victims, and I understand them, I'm not putting them down, but I hear victims get up and just want people, everything bad to happen to them, and you go back to those teachings that I learned a long time ago, they filter back into my mind about, you know, justice does come around to all of us if that's what you want. Mercy will stay with us forever if we give that. And I know in my own life, I mean, I can be the most unjust person in the world in many ways. I have that ability. I know that. I know my failings. You know, when I'm that person, good things aren't going to happen to me. And I think it's a teaching that we really need to reflect on. And I think particularly we're going into a presidential election. We're going to be talking again about crime and what we do with crime. Now we've taken our foot off the pedal a little bit. Mm-hmm. It isn't out of any real desire to help people. It's because we can't pay for it anymore. But the discussion has gotten back to, once again, as opposed to minimum mandatory punishments, keeping everybody in prison, we've got back to rehabilitation and treatment and stuff like that. However we get there is a good thing.
Yeah.
But we need more of that, because after being involved in this for 43 years, the thing that is clearest to me is that punishment for punishment's sake doesn't work. It just simply doesn't work. There are a segment of people that are bad, bad people that need to be put away. They can't play in the sandbox with the rest of us. Sorry. But that is a fairly small number of people.
When you were presented with the idea of defending Mark Hoffman, what were you thinking about? Did you ever wonder if you wanted to take – I mean, you take cases like this all the time, so I'm not saying that was particularly extraordinary, but give me a sense of how you were thinking about that.
Well, I mean, that guy was a different guy than I am. I mean, really, there's a Rumpel of the Bailey, if you're familiar with him.
I know you love Mortimer.
I love
Mortimer.
Yeah. I love John Mortimer. Yeah. I mean, I considered him a friend, although we only met a couple times, but we did correspond.
Oh, is that right?
But Mortimer, in one of the very first Rumpel of the Baileys, when Rumpel is writing his memoirs, talks about the guy, Rumpel, who was the young lawyer that he really doesn't know anymore. And he doesn't even know whether he would like him if he knew him. And so, I mean, that case comes up when I'm a fairly young lawyer and I'm really hungry. And so, I mean, I would assume my approach was, great, I can win anything. Bring it on.
But you don't regret anything from that experience, do you?
You were
a different guy, but I mean,
oh no, no. I mean, Mark and I still correspond, and I think I did a good job for him. I think we did. The defense team did, and we maintained a good relationship. I developed. And I think your listeners will be really surprised at this. Two very good friendships from that. Matt Christensen, Steve Christensen, one of the deceased's father, and Gary Sheets, who's lost his beloved wife at that time, Kathy. Gary and I were not good friends, but I mean, we became friendly at that time. And that was a...
How? How is that possible?
Well, I think I will give myself a small amount of credit. I will give Gary a small amount of credit. I will give Matt Christensen, Mr. Mac, tons of credit. We had a meeting, and I don't know how it started. Quite often in these cases, and I started this early, I will go to the prosecutor and say, hey, look, I'm not going to trash your victims or their family. That's not what this case is about. So I want you to let them know that. I've got to do my job, but this isn't personal. And if they have a question about something I do, they've got to come and talk to me about it. And there are people who think that that's a ploy and that's just the defense attorney trying to get sympathy. That's not true. In fact, I had a victim come and talk to me about a murder case that was tried 20 years ago just the other day. But it was it's
sought
true.
Sought you out to talk sought to me you about out. Why they needed a kind of
they needed some closure on
yeah,
it.
Yeah.
And so I think I did. I'm pretty certain that's how it started. So we met in a jury room over at the court, and Mac took the lead. He's about as good a guy as there is. I mean, if there's a heaven, Mac's going to be in charge of the choir. I mean, seriously. I mean, face it. He's going to be down standing in front. He's going to get them all dressed up nice, and he's going to make sure everything works and have his eye over it. He's a great guy. We talked, and Mac really carried the ball with it, with Gary. Gary was very upset. Gary had taken a lot of unfair crap prior to the case kind of moving on, and Mac just did it. I give him most of the credit. I learned a great deal from him at that point about understanding and mercy and justice and stuff like that.
Ron Jangich is with us, and we need to take a break. We'll be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER.
Friend, follow, and join us on social media to stay connected with the latest goings-on. Find out who's on Radio West tomorrow, what's happening on Capitol Hill, and get a glimpse behind the microphones with pictures and videos of station staff and special events. We're on Facebook, Instagram, Tumblr, and Twitter. Search for KUER 90.1.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio, back now with Ron Jangich. I want to keep going on this subject, the lessons you learned from not just the Mark Hoffman question, but this idea of being a victim, this idea of victimhood, because this is something that I know you've been thinking about a lot lately, this idea that everybody in America is a victim, victimhood identity, those
right.
kinds of things.
Yeah, I mean, I complain about it a lot. I mean, I have my own clients that conceive of themselves as victims, people who actually have done things that we're not talking about the innocent accused. I mean, the innocent accused, really, they have a right to feel that way. On the other hand, you've got to get beyond it and deal with the case as well. And a lot of people can't. And I think that we have taken victimhood, not victims' rights, which are very important.
Yeah.
And the unwillingness to get beyond it to a degree that we're really doing a harm to everybody. I hear people all the time say, well, I'm a victim of this or I'm a victim of that. I'll never get beyond it. I see judges and prosecutors and victims' rights counselors put their arms around them and say, yeah, you never will. Well, I disagree with that. Just as I disagree with the idea that I'm an alcoholic now and I'll be an alcoholic forever. I'm a drug addict now. I'll be a drug addict forever. I disagree with that fundamentally. We grow.
Wait, what? Oh, because we can not change but grow.
Yeah, we can.
Okay.
I mean, it's like I said a moment ago about the guy I was. I think I'm a better person now in most respects. Maybe not, but I believe I am. I'm not. I'm fundamentally that same guy, but I think I've learned to do things better. Even my own addictions, be it work or whatever. And I think that we've got to stop that. I think we've got to say we'll embrace you, we'll help you, we'll move on, but it can't become an excuse for your failure to do certain things. And again, I'm not saying that it is easy. I'm not saying that they aren't victims. I'm saying we've got to move on. The flip side of that, however, is I think that in American society today, we focus far too much in the media on the defendant. Every time I see the picture of the kid who survived in the Boston Marathon bombing, the defendant, I just go crazy. And my wife will tell you that when I see it on TV. Or when I see them them, meaning the media, continuing to flash the picture of the kid in Oregon and want to talk about him not having a girlfriend or whatever. It drives me nuts. We should not extol that in this country. And by that, I mean, okay, if there's a trial to be had, let's talk about it. If there's a defense to be had, let's talk about it. But when these people, like the guy in Oregon, and we can have sympathy for him, we can even have offer them mercy in our prayers, let's not make celebrities out of them. It really irritates me, because my own experience in the law is that these people like that. And there are people out there that may be a little bit off center who see that, and that becomes their ability to get fame. In this most recent instance, he even said that. And when we keep doing that, I think that we really do a great disservice to the victims. This is the 100th anniversary of the Joe Hill execution.
Yeah.
One of the most beautiful things that the Joe Hill Committee did was to bring the Morrison and the Haglund families together. When I was teaching that—
This was the family the grocer killed.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And when I was teaching that, a class about that at the UN, which I did for about 20 years, one of my students, and this is a long ago before anybody else had done it, went out and interviewed Merlin Morrison and some of the Morrison family. And they were genuine victims of this crime. And no one ever embraced them. All they heard was about Joe Hill. Now, we can disagree about Hill's guilt or innocence, but to them, he killed their dad or grandpa and their brother, their uncle. And I thought it was very telling that the Joe Hill Committee did that. I thought it was a beautiful deal for them to do. And so it isn't only about a case that is identified with somebody like the Oregon guy or the Boston Marathon guys and their names being at the top of it. These other people are the ones that we really should be thinking about. So, I mean, when I talk about victimhood, I'm not dismissing that it exists. We got to find a way of moving on. But we've got to stop the idea in this country that this police blotter mentality is something that we want to constantly go to when we're talking about the criminal justice system.
Has there ever been a time, and you don't have to be specific about a case, when you, the day after someone was acquitted, or even convicted, doesn't really matter, you felt regret about being involved, that you felt taken in some way by someone? You know what I mean?
No.
I shouldn't have done that. That was a mistake.
No.
I blew that. Nope.
No. I mean, I have felt regret that maybe I should have done this better, or I shouldn't have done that, or whatever, tactically. You get over that fairly quick. But there are two instances that come to mind, and I felt really that I was taken in by the way the prosecution handled the case and their duplicity in handling it. As for my clients, no. I mean, I'm pretty open with them and demand that of them with me when we're dealing with cases. I mean, people are going to BS you consciously or subconsciously in this system that we have, and good lawyers have a fairly good meter for that. Some of it slips by.
Is there a speech that you have? Maybe it may not be the exact same thing, but when you sit them down for the first time and say something to the effect of, I'm just trying to imagine, you need to be honest with me.
Well, I try to tell my clients always that every case is different, and that there are two aspects to every case. One is guilt or innocence, and one is if you are guilty of this or some lesser crime, then we've got to look at both of them. And so basically, I always start out every case with both things in mind. And so, for example, I will immediately have people get me lists of people that can be supportive as far as character is concerned and stuff like that, looking forward to the eventuality that we could be convicted of something or they could plead to something. But the other thing is that it's also my job then, and I consider this a big part of my job, to determine whether they've got problems, whether they're guilty or innocent that we got to deal with. You know, there are a lot of interestingly enough, a lot of people that are charged with like drug offenses or even alcohol offenses, that individual case, they may flat out be not guilty. They may be innocent. They may not be able to prove the case against them. But when you look at them and you see that they have significant drug or alcohol problems or sometimes mental problems, it's your job as a lawyer to move as quickly as you can on that to help them. And so, yeah, I mean, I look at all of that from the beginning, and we have – I don't know that it's a common speech. It's probably tailored to individuals depending upon age and whatever, but we talk about those things. It's harder to talk about young people about that now than it was when I started. And it's not just because I'm older than them. Younger people today have a totally different – the mean side of me would say warped view of responsibility and ethical conduct as it relates to them vis-a-vis society. And so
– whereas, wait, so before talking 20 years ago, there was some sense that even though they needed to be defended, they had an inkling of their responsibility in all of this, and it's not quite there as much as it was?
I don't think so. I really don't. I think that one of the things that we have lost in the me-first society is our collective responsibility to everybody around us. Now, all of us fail at that. Let me raise my hand. I certainly do every day. But I think people from past generations, and I'm not talking about psychopaths or people. I'm talking about normal people. You screw up, that's a bad thing. You feel like you're going to be ostracized, that you know you've let your family down, you've let this person down, you've let your teachers down, you let everybody down. I don't see that as much anymore. I mean, we have TV programs on where Orange is the New Black, all right? Let me tell you what. I saw that starting a long time ago, where it's cool to have gone to jail. You know, having a conviction doesn't mean anything. We don't, and I don't mean this in the truest sense, but in the general sense, we don't ostracize people anymore for screwing up. People that are sports athletes or people in the celebrity community, it may increase your celebrity cachet on the street if you get into trouble. And I see that as a genuine problem. Whereas in the past, I think that was a different thing. And that is one of the governors that we have on our behavior. And it's where I really disagree with somebody that politically I'm attuned with, Bill Maher. I mean, I think he's a smart man, but I again, my poor wife doesn't like to watch certain programs with me, but you just go, you know what, Bill, there is a time when a moral or ethical component of life in America or in the world has some ability to keep people in place so the rest of us can play.
Well, you know, that's actually an interesting segue, because I know one of the things Bill Maher goes after all the time is religion. This is something that and there's this great story that I want you to talk about, because I mean, you born Catholic, raised Catholic, and then you kind of I've read you where you've talked about how you, even when you weren't so Catholic, you would still every once in a while go light a candle. But there's the story that plays out. This was 10 years ago, 2004. In New Jersey, this 8-year-old girl, she had celiac disease. So she couldn't eat wheat.
Right.
Her priest she's about to have her first communion. Her priest is like, okay, you can take a rice wafer for communion. That's okay. Even though it's technically not quite there. You have to have wheat in it, whatever. And the New Jersey bishop invalidates her communion. And you were pissed.
I was hot, yeah. The, pre-Vatican II Catholics, no matter what they tell you, never leave, really. And that's a good thing. I was hot.
But here's what's interesting to me about this story.
Yeah.
It didn't make you leave Catholicism for good. You got closer to Catholicism.
Yeah, I think the thing about that is that it was because of a great shepherd, and that was Archbishop George Niederauer. I wrote this really nasty letter. My secretary took out all of the four-letter words, I'm sure, and saying how stupid I thought that was. I mean, transubstantiation aside, there was a better way to handle it. And a big part of my point was, I disagreed with that was what canon law said. Remember, I went to a Jesuit school. I mean, I was taught to argue.
Yeah.
Taught to argue with my dad. But I also said, I thought this was wrong, to do this to the family and to do it publicly. Well, and he called me and we went to lunch with a really nice lady named Barbara Lee, who once ran the Intermountain Catholic paper. And his basic deal was, I don't necessarily disagree with you, and he gave me the reasons for it, but, who are you to complain? Basically, I mean, do you go to Mass? Do you go to church? What do you do? And it hit me. And I don't like people. It's part of my beef with the media, really, and you know this because you and I know one another. Don't complain about how I try a case. Come down and unleash a chain occasionally and see how easy it is. And then go and give yourself 38 seconds about where you screwed up. I don't like that. And he, much nicer than me, didn't kind of like my criticism, I'm sure. And so I thought, you've been moving there back there anyway, so it's time to start again. And I did.
You're an usher. Are you still an usher on Sunday morning?
I am.
At the Cathedral of the Madeleine?
I am.
You still wear your St. Francis medal?
Every day.
You've it right there?
Yep.
Talk about the Pope, speaking of St. Francis.
Yeah, I mean, he's a good guy. I mean, I'm reading, I'll give a plug. You want to read a great book about the Pope, and there are a bunch of them out there. It's called The Great Reformer. And I'm just about done with it.
Is this James Carroll?
No.
No.
Carroll's book is good, too.
It is
but
good.
This
yeah.
is, and I'll tell you why this, The Great Reformer, is good, because it goes into the heart of Argentina and the whole thing where he was as a young priest and a young man and a Jesuit formation guy and all of these things and a bishop and a cardinal dealing with the political currents. And you find out that what he is really, he took the right name. He wants the church, but forget the church. He wants all of us to get to the periphery and deal with the marginalized people in the world.
And forget the culture wars and forget worrying about all of that stuff.
Whether or not he talked to a woman who
right.
we may, in my political spectrum, think was a lunatic who's been divorced four times but didn't want other people to marry. And to forget whether or not there are things that conservative Catholics don't like that he said or other people. You want to find God, go to the periphery. That's where God is, whatever you want to call God, because that's your brother. That's your sister. Those are the people that you literally have to deal with it. And don't carry your political party card with you when you do it. Just go deal with them. And in that respect, I think that he gets back to the true voice. So many of the great religious people not talk show hosts like Bill Maher that I really admire. People like Dorothy Day.
In other words, getting to the core of what the Gospels were about, at least from the way you saw it?
Yeah, I think so. And I think so also, not just talking about it, not just complaining about what isn't being done. I mean, that was Bishop Niederauer's point to me. So, all right, well, do something about it, which is to say, then go down, you know. Dorothy Day started the Catholic Worker Movement. St. Francis of Assisi went out and he took care of the poor. The people like St. Francis de Sales and other people in our church, Martin Luther King, great people like that. In our own society here in Utah, the idea of a bishop storehouse, the idea of crossing lines without any payback for it. Another great example, the Cathedral of the Madeleine. Who helped redo it? The LDS Church. Okay? Crossing lines, and when you cross the line, not being afraid to have done it. And so I think that's his message. So it's a religious message for many of us.
Yeah.
But again, it's a culturally sensitive message. If we want America, if we want the world to be a good place, the word he constantly uses and has used for years, as I read about him, dialogue. You can't advance if you won't talk. And if what you say is, I'm not going to talk to you because you're this, that how can I maybe learn from you? But more importantly, if really what I'm doing to do is trying to show you where I'm right, how can you learn from me if I won't talk to you and have a dialogue with you? I think, and that goes back to my mom.
Really?
Well, sure. I mean, to bring it home, my mom didn't want me to run away from Utah.
Yeah.
Okay? Now, I think hers were different reasons, but it kind of brings it full circle. Mother Teresa said to people, I want to come to Calcutta to help you. Don't come to Calcutta, India. You got Calcutta down the street from you. And really, that's what Francis is saying. And I think it's a universal message. It's why people love him. People who don't believe in God. People who don't believe in anything. But when you get a message from a guy like that, you recognize, I've got to believe in something else than me.
Let me ask you this finally. It's interesting reading Doug Robinson wrote what I thought was a really nice profile of you exactly 10 years ago. And in it, you said, mind you were speaking after having been an attorney for 30 years. You said 30 years, how much, I'm asking myself, how much is left in the well? Is it worth it at this point? Where do I go from here? You've been doing this 43 years now.
Yeah.
Are you still thinking about those things these days?
Yeah. I mean, I've been an attorney for 40 years, but I worked at Legal Defenders when I was in law school, and I count those 3 years I've been involved in the system. Yeah, I do. I don't know. I mean, it's harder. The practice of law has changed. It's another one of my big complaints. We have rolled into a business model as lawyers. We're consumer-driven and not justice-driven. And that is something that makes it harder for everybody to make a living and also for everybody to practice law, at least in my judgment, in the way it should be done professionally. It's a profession. I mean, when we use that word in your business as a profession, that means something. I mean, to you, Walter Cronkite means something. He was a professional. And so I think that that is the thing that when I go, how much longer can I do it? I think that that has a big aspect of it. And so I don't know. I'll probably be doing this, God willing, and the cricks don't rise when I'm 65, now 75.
Ron Yingich. Ron, thanks.
Thanks, man.
Radio West, a production of KUER News, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.